Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Here we are on Saturday, August the 15th, the feast day of the Assumption. I assume you knew that?
Oh, gosh, Chris. That was a terrible way to start. Anyway, yes, I would go along with your assumption. I hope you're growing in holiness and you can be assumed into heaven one day and be with the Blessed Virgin Mary, where she will give you a hard time and all these bad jokes you've given.
Recreational DNA testing, like Ancestry.com, is illegal in France.
It's illegal?
It is. And
really?
And EU privacy laws restrict the use of DNA tests for catching a criminal. Yet French police use the FBI, the US FBI, to run a genetic genealogy search on crime scene DNA that was collected in a series of rape cases across France. The FBI used the public ancestry databases in the US to finally identify the serial rapist tied to five rapes across France from 1998 to 2008. So ultimately, they found the guy who was responsible and the suspect confessed to police and then later died by suicide in prison before trial.
Okay.
I want to look at how the Catholic Church would view the use of DNA from people who never consented to law enforcement use of that data. So the arguments in favor might be that the common good would say that the government has the responsibility to protect its citizens, and a serial rapist left uncaught for 24 years represents a threat to that.
Sure.
Catholic social teaching doesn't require using the most maximal tool available, but it does permit using necessary and proportionate means to prevent severe harms when other means have been exhausted, which I think is essentially what the French government argument was here for using the FBI route.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, human dignity and consent would say that people are not to be instrumentalized for others' ends, even good ends. Some would say that your genetic identity is bound up with your personal dignity, and being drawn into a criminal investigation through a relative's decision touches that without your say. Also, the expansive use of state surveillance contend towards abuse, and the fact that France had to outsource the search to the FBI to avoid domestic legal liability is problematic. I mean, the fact that there exists this law to begin with is a sign that there's a genuine risk worth protecting against. So what are your thoughts on the French government going about doing the end around?
In this case, I really don't see a problem from a moral standpoint of because the privacy rights are not absolute. Dignity of the human person is, but privacy rights are not absolute. For example, parents have a right to see what their kids are looking at on their cell phones. A government has a right to kind of keep track and make sure that terrorists are not, you know, utilizing the cellular networks to communicate how they're going to orchestrate a terrorist attack. So privacy rights are not absolute from a moral standpoint. Now, where this becomes complicated is how it gets enshrined in national laws. So in Europe in general, they have had a much greater propensity to protect the privacy of individuals. And this is true. I mean, when I was in Italy living there, I was really surprised at the privacy that they had, like in the use of Facebook, for example. So it was much more difficult for Facebook to share information and do different things. And you had to sign all kinds of waivers. That being able to send emails to people is much more complicated in Europe. So their privacy laws tend to be much more restringent in the European Union than they are here in the United States, which is kind of strange because in the United States we talk all about privacy rights and things, but it's actually more restrictive there. So I think how these get enshrined in law, the respect for privacy is going to vary. But let's not forget that there is a hierarchy of rights, and they are based on natural law. So the inherent dignity of the human person is much more important than privacy. And in certain cases, that can be circumvented.
Well, I don't like this at all. And I'll tell you why. Because if you were to have this DNA...
But to clarify, what aspect of it you like?
Well, I'm going to tell you. So if you were to be facing a prosecution and this DNA evidence was presented against you, it would seemingly be scientifically just open and shut, right? We've got
not
your
necessarily.
DNA.
Well, it's let's just one go, factor
just go,
of
just,
evidence.
Yeah, we'll just go along with, right, because I read a book that was fascinating about the criminal that was caught in the Pacific Northwest that they got through a discarded coffee cup, mm-hmm. That this guy had been a serial killer in the Pacific Northwest, and I thought it was really fascinating the way that they got him. But what I really don't like about this is, you know, the way they relied on this evidence, and it turned out, I mean, it just seemed like this definitely was the guy, mm-hmm. but there are recent stories. I don't know if you've heard these things about these AI systems autonomously escaping and hacking systems.
Yes, I have.
Without them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody wrote an article about the threat to these DNA databases being not secure, and they could easily be hacked. No one's tried it yet, but what about, you know, an autonomous hack that muddies the water and poisons the DNA database that you don't know about,
mm-hmm.
right? And no one even thought about this until recently, right? And the, you know,
risks are there. There's no doubt. And there's a lot of things we will not be able to safeguard against. You know, as a priest, I have to think about this all the time because, you know, I don't have a privacy in my life in a certain sense. Everything I do can become public knowledge, and it can scandalize or can hurt people or can elevate them. And so sometimes the privacy laws have been accentuated by people who want to hide things from their past. And I think in a certain sense, everything's going to be revealed on the last day.
Right.
So if we can live our lives before God.
I do like this idea, though, of consent being required.
No, I don't disagree with that. And I think there's a space for that type of dialogue and diversity of opinions to say, all right, what's the best way to safeguard these principles that we hold dear?
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. A Wall Street Journal opinion piece tackled the erosion of the taboo against speaking ill of the dead after the sudden passing of Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. The piece argues that there has been this ancient near universal convention found across all cultures from Islam to Judaism to Christianity to not speak poorly of the dead. But in our era of political polarization, that societal norm is breaking down, particularly in America and Britain. Many commentators reacted to Graham's death in July with good riddance type comments, the same way they did when Charlie Kirk was murdered. And it's not limited.
Yeah, it's just poor taste.
Yeah, it's poor taste. And it's not limited to the left, as Donald Trump has said he was glad when Robert Mueller died. And he also joked about the deceased Michigan Democratic congressman looking up at him from hell after he died in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't new either. The ancient Romans and French revolutionary figures gleefully mocked political opponents' deaths. So
sometimes even exhumed their bodies and made fun of them.
To desecrate.
Yeah, it's really sick things that have happened throughout history.
So Matthew chapter 7 says, "Judge not that you not be judged," and is frequently read as a blanket ban on the moral evaluation of any kind.
Which is a totally mistaken notion.
Right? So there's other verses that Christ is telling people to judge trees by their fruits and to rebuke a brother who sins.
Right.
I would think the church, though, would universally frown on judging the dead and gloating over their demise. What would you say about this?
Well, the approach of the church is let's pray for the dead.
Yeah.
I mean, Christ in his mercy wants everyone to be saved. And so we should be praying for the dead rather than denigrating them.
So what would the church say? I don't know what, say, particularly happened in the Vatican or if there was ever a statement for anybody in the Vatican when Hitler died.
Mm-hmm.
If you're gloating over the dead, I don't think the church, even when Hitler died, they didn't gloat over his death.
No, never. I mean,
right? So there's a difference between saying, you know, I'm glad somebody's dead who murdered millions versus gloating over someone who disagreed with me politically.
Right.
Right.
Using it as a cheap way to score points or to vilify a person. I think these type of comments actually are more indicative of the person who's making them. And I think this is why naturally there's an aversion to speaking ill of the dead, because if you've got a good character, you're going to say, all right, they're in God's mercy now. They're going to stand before the judgment seat of God. I don't need to judge them. And they're not going to do any more harm in this world. There is a little bit of distinction when you talk about thinkers, philosophers, or theologians whose ideas persist after their death. But then it's an attack of the ideas, the merits of the ideas, whether they're good or bad, true or false. And I think there you can make a distinction. So let's leave judgment of the person to God, but we can argue about the ideas. And I think this is a really important distinction that we also need to make in our culture today, because we have cancel culture, right? Where if you don't agree with the person's ideas, you just cut them out of your life. That is not a healthy way to approach human relationships. We need to make the opposite distinction. We should always include and invite people into our lives, into connection, but not be afraid to challenge the ideas. And I think it's the fear of confronting ideas that sometimes leads people to just, I'm going to cut that person out of my life. And that's not a healthy approach.
Well, I don't know if it's nature or nurture, but I get this sense of unease whenever I'm, you know, I'll often talk about, like, both my parents are deceased, mm-hmm. and when I'm with my siblings, we'll talk about the annoying things or stupid things that my parents did, you know, particularly my dad in some ridiculous ways, you know, and then I get the sense of unease afterwards, like, well, right. I shouldn't be saying these things, you know?
No, you probably shouldn't. You want to honor the dead. You want to honor the memory of your parents. And yeah, of course, we're all human. We have our foibles. We have our mistakes that we make. But let's, you know, honor the dead, leave them in God's mercy, and try to bring out the positive.
The Wall Street Journal explores a study that found by age 18 in the state of Oregon, about 1 in 240 girls and 1 in 630 boys had received gender transitioning hormone treatment between the years of 2016 and 2023,
wow.
which is roughly double or triple, sorry, triple for girls and double the national averages, respectively.
Wow.
Among 14 to 15 year olds, the rate was 4 to 5 times the national rate, and puberty blocker use at age 14 was over 5 times the national rate.
And what are the causes that are driving that?
Well, let's just dig a little further into these stats. About 1.5% of Oregon girls and 0.5% of boys received a gender-related diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is 10 times the prevalence of type 2 diabetes diagnoses in that age group. 10 times.
That's absurd.
So Oregon's the only state in the U.S. to have formally adopted the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, that's some organization, standards of care. Okay, they've got a standards of care. They're the only state that's adopted it. Mm-hmm. And the authors of this Wall Street Journal piece think that this has created a case of policy in Oregon, mm-hmm. in this case, creating demand rather than responding to it.
Clearly.
They attribute the outcome to a combination of one-party politics and what they call an activist-captured medical and child welfare system. So isn't this comparison of teens' diagnoses being 10 times greater than the diagnoses of type 2 diabetes, and just like right there in and of itself, just proof that Oregon is creating this demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what to add to that, Chris. I mean, it's pretty clear. Policies have consequences, and this is why it's important to really examine our policies and make sure that they are based on biological realities and facts and not on ideology. Because when you start creating some of these bearing incentives into the process and into policies, it does create problems.
Yeah, these poor kids. I mean, 1.5% of Oregon girls. I mean, that's just tragic. I mean, it's just child abuse.
Thousands and thousands of children that are just being, misguided. And
well, on the good news front in Oregon, you remember we talked a couple episodes about a ballot initiative for them to ban all types of fishing and hunting.
Mm-hmm. That lost.
Yes, it didn't garner enough votes to make it on the November ballot. Right. So,
you know, that would really help these kids who are struggling with transgenderism, that they went out and fished and hunted.
Get out
and
gotten wild. Yeah. Get off
in
your
contact
phones.
With nature a little bit
get
more.
Get off social media.
Oh, yeah. It would be so helpful.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
A grassroots parent movement is pushing to restore recess time in American schools, reversing the decades-long trend where schools have cut unstructured playtime in favor of more class time. Recess, as you know, used to be the standard in U.S. elementary schools, but since the early 2000s, there's been this huge pressure to raise standardized test scores after the passing of the No Child Left Behind Act, mm-hmm. which was signed in 2002.
And how's that turned out?
Yeah. Well, many schools have reduced or eliminated recess, and state mandated instructional hour requirements don't count the recess time, right? So they're if they're going to have recess, basically they're adding to the school day, and they don't want to do that. So a Tennessee mom got involved after discovering her kindergartner's school gave only 20 minutes of daily recess for a kindergartner.
Ouch.
She helped push a Tennessee law, which was passed last year, requiring at least 40 minutes of recess for elementary school kids. She now heads a nonprofit with chapters in 20 states advocating for at least 60 minutes of screen-free, unstructured play daily. So I couldn't find, what got me thinking about this was, or I got thinking about a different, you know, subject related to this. I couldn't find any studies that examine the correlation between boys, the well-known statistic of boys falling behind in academic performance in recent decades versus girls. So I was looking whether or not anything was correlating this lack of recess time since the No Child Left Behind, and whether or not that was related. So I couldn't find any studies, but there was a study by the National Bureau of Economic Research done in 2013 that shows from the 1980s to the 2000s that the statistical occurrence of the mode, i.e. the most common grade given to girls, has shifted from B's to A's, while boys' distribution stayed centered on B's. And the study also concluded that there's the larger relative share of boys obtaining C's can be accounted for by a higher frequency of school misbehavior. So that sums it up to me that, you know, nowadays teachers would suggest, they prefer to suggest putting boys on ADHD drugs rather than advocating for this free unstructured playtime of recess. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of ways we could go with this, but it immediately evokes the research of Dr. Leonard Sachs, who looked on the differences between boys and girls in school situations. And at least at the elementary school level, the predominance of teachers, they're female. And the way that female teachers tend to structure their classroom is a lot of structure, got to sit and be quiet, which is really antithetical to the nature of boys. And so that's why boys get a predominant percentage of these designations as having ADHD and get designated with bad behavior. And then they start hating school. And so Leonard Sachs had already made the case that boys need more free play time. They need a little bit more unstructured. They need a little more freedom to move. And then they will learn, but they learn in a different way than girls do. And I think that is lost sometimes on some of the female
teachers.
And
it's because we're a slave. You know, it's not necessarily, it's lost on maybe some of the female teachers down in early elementary school level, but we're a slave to these standardized test scores now.
Yeah, and I think we're also forgetting the nature of what you actually learn in recess. Think about it for a moment. I mean, you learn how to get along with other kids. You learn how to associate with people in society. You learn different personality types. You learn how to follow the rules, or if not, you get punished by the people around you. I mean, there's so many things we pick up from free play,
absolutely,
from recess time.
I still today remember, as like a fifth grader, one of the kids from recess sat down with me and said, "We've all been talking and we don't want you playing kickball with us anymore because you're arguing the line calls all the time," which, by the way, I was right.
Of course. I can't imagine you arguing about anything.
But it really struck me that these kids got together and were
colluded.
Yeah. And they're like, maybe
to
I
put
am.
You in line.
Yeah. Maybe. And so, you know,
you get some real important feedback.
And
I
still remember that.
Yeah.
So
I can think back to conversations like that in recess as well. You know, I have different personalities. I didn't get that talking to that you got, but I can remember other things that there's so many things you learn from that. And I think perhaps there's a little bit of pride in teachers and instructors thinking that they're the only way that knowledge and wisdom can be transferred to students.
I looked forward to going to school because of recess. And if for that reason alone.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and it gave you an outlet.
That's why recess should be.
We had recess, I think, if I remember correctly, when I was a little kid, we had it in the halfway through the morning and in the afternoon as well,
right,
or right after lunch.
Yeah.
And it gave you a time to just get some energy out and then be able to refocus.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. Germany has a constitutional ban on Sunday shopping rooted in Article 140 of the 1949 Basic Law, which I guess was inherited from the Weimar Constitution, which designates Sundays as days of rest from work and of spiritual elevation. Stores can only sell necessities.
What a novel idea.
Well,
that'd be really
interesting. They can only sell necessities such as bread and, of course, thank God, beer, while broader goods like canned beans remain off limits, with enforcement occasionally being a real thing, with one grocer who was fined 2,500 euros for selling non-perishables on a Sunday.
Really? Interesting.
So Germany's economy has been stagnant since 2019 as their manufacturing export-based model has faltered in the face of the competition from the Chinese.
So and the also because of their energy policy, because it's become so expensive for their energy.
Yep. And so now the government has proposed watering down the Sunday rule as a stimulus effort. But this has resulted in to allow Sunday shopping to stimulate the economy.
Uh-huh.
But this has resulted in retail groups pushing for full deregulation of the Sunday shopping, saying anything should be allowed to be sold instead of some half measure. So in practice, Germany's legal distinction between work on Sunday, which is banned, and work for Sunday, which allows activities that enable everybody else's rest. Mm-hmm. It's a bit clunky because cucumbers and Coke are sellable as snacks, but zucchini and canned beans aren't because they require cooking.
Okay.
I was really surprised to learn that secular Germany still has these rules in place, but a quote from a trade union member kind of explains a little better the thinking that it's not about keeping the Sabbath holy. She said a work-free Sunday is an absolute social achievement. Mm-hmm. The fact that so many people can have time off at the same time is a significant cultural asset.
It really is.
So I don't think the church would necessarily, maybe you'll disagree, be in favor of a state-sponsored Sunday rest strictly for religious observance, for a religiously pluralistic society like Germany. I don't know. Do you?
I would. I think there's, as a secular woman, brought to the fore, I mean, it is a cultural achievement that we can actually relax as a society.
But that's for the different reason, not for the Sunday observance.
No, I get it. I get it. But there can be, I mean, the ideal is if the church and the state can align on what are the goods that need to be defended for the flourishing of the human person. This is a case where natural law and human nature align with God's law.
Okay, and I agree, but think through this now. Germany is becoming increasingly more Muslim.
Yes.
And they
might shift it to Friday.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So like if you make it only on Sunday and for the reason of religious observance, well then in a pluralistic society, it's not going to work.
But the way it's stipulated in their constitution is that it is a day of rest.
And for spiritual elevation. That's what it says. And for spiritual elevation. So that's the part that I think the church would, I mean, I don't think the church wants us to observe Sunday as a day of rest because the state tells us to.
Correct.
They want you to individually make that choice to observe Sunday as a holy day.
Yes, but if the laws of the nation can reinforce what is good practice for us from a spiritual perspective.
Right, but what if Germany becomes 51% Muslim?
Well, then they'll have the debate about when that day of rest should be. But they'll cross that bridge when they come to it. I don't think it's coming to that quite yet.
Well, among the comments to the article that I read were some folks who had previously lived in Germany, and they called it the most, the Sunday no shopping thing. They said it was the most inconvenient thing about Germany and stated that it's that way for no other reason than that's the way we've always done it, which I think is what German manufacturing is now encountering. Mm-hmm. This is the way we've always done it. And they're kind of blind to how China is doing things and undercutting them and whatnot. So it's an interesting thing. I just didn't know that Germany, especially with them so sort of, anti-religious, that they had this Sunday shopping thing still.
Yeah, but even that criticism, I mean, it's inconvenient. Okay, but you safeguard a lot of things by that as well.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of changing habits. So if you know that Chick-fil-A is not open on Sundays, on Sundays I'm not going to go to Chick-fil-A, and you adjust your patterns. If you know as a German citizen that, I'm not going to be able to shop on Sunday, you do your shopping on other days of the week.
Yeah, but I think the church's official stance here would be for the reasons of community that Catholic social teaching encourages, this ability to have community, and not necessarily for you to observe your religious obligation from a nation standpoint, not what the church wants you to do. Like within the Catholic Church, you have to observe your Sunday obligation. But I'm saying for a nation's law, I think that they would be in favor of this for that latter reason of the sense of community, because that is a good thing. And it's what, it's what happens when stores aren't open. You're forced to be outside, conversing with your neighbors or recreating in some other ways.
Yeah, but let's take a step back for just a moment, Chris, because we can look at this from a legalistic standpoint, which is like the church has a law that we got to observe the Sunday rest. But why does the church have that law, if you will? It's to safeguard the good of the human person. We need a break. We need time. And so I think looking at it from strictly a legalistic standpoint is going to be always shortchanging the deeper reality. The church is recognizing that in our human nature requires rest. We need a time to detach. We need a time to break away from our normal obligations. And the laws of the church are not merely arbitrary things just set out there like to make our lives difficult. They're acknowledging something that God has put within human nature to safeguard us from our own aggressiveness.
Research from the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate. I'm not sure what the heck that is.
Hey, that's an organization I worked with for my doctoral dissertation. Father Tom Gaunt, a Jesuit, is the head of that organization.
Okay.
Well, they do a lot of interesting research on the Catholic Church and sociological trends and things.
Well, they found that more than 70% of Catholics are married to Catholic spouses, with younger Catholics only slightly more likely to report being married to a non-Catholic.
Okay.
And the Pew Research 2025 data on religious intermarriage more broadly found 7% of married U.S. adults who are Christians have a spouse from a different Christian tradition. So it kind of, you know, mirrors what the, what this 70%.
Somewhat similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Catholics marrying non-Catholics rate really hasn't changed lately, but what has changed is the number of Catholics getting married at all, and specifically the number of Catholics getting married in a church.
Right.
So the Catholics opting out of sacramental marriage altogether. So between 2000 and 2012, church weddings in America dropped by 40%, even as the Catholic population grew, and Australia reports a similar pattern.
Mm-hmm.
The trend to do destination weddings that are not held in churches is under canon law a requirement for a Catholic's marriage to be valid in the eyes of the church. It has to be celebrated before a properly delegated priest or deacon and two witnesses in the canonical form. A Catholic who gets married in a vineyard by a friend who got ordained online is not sacramentally or canonically married in the eyes of the church.
Well, I would just clarify, let's say that they were to get divorced later on, the church would recognize that they were married in the eyes of God. Okay. But the canonical form should be within a church.
All right. So just what do you think about this trend, though, towards destination weddings?
It's a societal trend, and I think it's driven a lot by looking what other people do. And I think what the key here is to bring people back to evaluation of the beauty of having your marriage blessed by God, having all that extra grace in a beautiful place. And so that's just a matter of
education. Yeah, I mean, it's an ecclesial act. It's not a show.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.